Thanks, by the way, for the Rocky Raccoon thing.
Isn't
everybody
that crazy?
Knew her. Everyone knew her as Nancy. Rocky Raccoon, RR, but everyone called her Nancy. That's pretty good.
But then there's also a doc, right? It's basically about a shooting, a murder, and he's there's also a doc in there. So if this all came out of the Shining thing, your RR came out of the Red Rum Shining. Well, he says, doctor came in stinking of gin. Oh, so he says, I can't think of the line of the one, but he says, doc. They refer to him as doc. You know, the doctor comes in, but then he says, like, doc, I'll be better. They referred to him as doc twice. And I just think the idea of in The Shining, the like, what's up, doc? And how Danny is doc.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah, and then Dr. Parnassus, when they're on the duet boat, and he's dead already, you know, you have another actor there, and you see Tom, what's his name, the singer, who's the devil in Dr. Parnassus?
Tom Waits,
and he goes, and then right when he realizes that he's actually in hell, his heaven turns out to be a hell, and he sees the dead cow. He goes, what's up, doc? It's pretty good. I've been wanting to get... If you guys can get images of that, how do you get the screenshots like that? I've tried to figure out how to do it. Use Premiere or something?
Load it up
I don't get
VLC.
It.
I just load them up in VLC and press Shift-F.
Oh.
If you're working from DVD or video, I'm not sure where you're working from.
Okay. Cool. Good to know. Yeah, so those are some good shots to have, actually, are that particular scene. I forget who the actor is at the time that's portraying Tony in the film, Dr. Parnassus. I'm spacey right now.
Oh, fuck. Tony, wait, okay. I feel like this point is retarded, but yes. Tony the Tiger from Frosted Flakes always shows the lightning bolt coming down into him. So here we
go. Yeah, which is on the shelf in The Shining, by the way.
Is it really?
Yes.
So you realize Charlie Sheen said he had tiger blood.
Whoa! That's too good.
That's perfect.
Heath Ledger is named fucking Tony in Dr. Parnassus. Parnassus is a mountain sacred to Apollo. Danny wears the fucking Apollo shirt. Tony is the little boy who lives in the back of his throat. How does fucking Tony die in Dr. Parnassus but through strangulation with being hung with a lance?
Yes.
That's weird. That's all I'm saying.
He puts the flute down his throat to prevent it. But this is, you know, when he says, where does Tony live? Tony lives in my stomach, right? He goes down my throat and he lives in my stomach. So the way he's able to avoid the hang is he's constantly putting this flute or this second voice.
Wow, that's heavy.
Right?
Yes. Totally. Interesting. Yeah.
Well, Christ is born in Bethlehem, which is the house of bread or the stomach again. This is all very alchemical.
Totally.
Yeah. I think I'm going to have to watch Parnassus and Shining side by side. That's really interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
Hey, Jason, Parnassus.
Jason, can you go into the Red Rum, Red Room connection alchemically?
No. Okay. We can take it in a number of ways that seem equally valid, and I'm not sure which is the right way. I think you guys kind of touched on the red rum as like the red elixir, and then like the rubedo. But then I was also kind of thinking like the rue morgue in Edgar Allan Poe, which is what I was riffing on before, as a place where murders happen.
Right. Totally.
Is it too much of
however you want.
Is it too much of a stretch Terry Gilliam, who directed Parnassus, also directed Johnny Depp in Fear and Loathing, and which then is followed up by the Rum Diaries.
Whoa. Yeah, no, that's great. I love it. Well, I've been looking at a bunch of things with Hunter recently. He's been coming up a lot, actually. You know, the what was I making a connection with White Rabbit in a previous blog with that he's like wants him to play White Rabbit. Terry Gilliam. Oh shit, I need to look up some stuff again. But yeah.
So I think it's interesting, you guys were talking about the Red Room. On an early Mask of God post, we talked about the Mask of the Red Death, and how you go through all the different rooms to end up in the Red Room. Are you guys familiar with the story?
Another Edgar Allan Poe story.
Yeah. I believe there's like seven rooms. I haven't read it in a while, but I believe there's seven rooms, and it's telling this sort of story of like going to this party, and I believe it's like a masquerade. It's like very much like an Eyes Wide Shut, right? They're all wearing, it's a masquerade ball, and I believe like he's walking through the different rooms in this building, and they're all like a different color. And then he ends up in the Red Room is the final room. And I believe it was supposed to be, if I'm not mistaken, stages of the Black Plague. I've heard that.
What book is this?
It's called The Mask of the Red Death. It's Edgar Allan Poe.
Is there any relevance to the fact that in The Shining, the Red Room that can be identified is basically the elevator that spills out the ocean of red blood, but you never see any scene of them in the elevator.
In the elevator, yeah, totally.
That's a good point, yeah.
And then there's the whole connection to the Red Room in 2001, in which Bowman goes into to disconnect Hal. That it's this big grid that's shining red, and he's wearing the red astronaut suit. And this is where he is, the logic and memory center, which he goes into to take down Hal.
Well, yeah, well played.
Comparable to the Eyes Wide Shut scene in the red circle where he takes off his mask. And of course, the red cloak guy is the Red Death again.
I always thought that when I watched the scene of Dave Bowman disconnecting Hal, when they show the sort of what's actually, I guess, a side view, but it looks like overhead because Dave's kind of floating there. So you see the reflection on his helmet. It looks like this like ridiculously cartoonish smiling like gecko or lizard.
Yeah.
And I can't not see that. Like every time I've seen that movie, I can't help but see this like weird like lizardy smiley face. And I think of the idea that he's destroying the logic center and which would essentially be reducing him to a reptilian brain. Basic life support. I don't know how much of that's just totally in my imagination that I'm seeing that, but like any time I've seen that movie I can't see that scene without seeing this weird smiley face on his helmet of like this almost just the very shape of it makes it almost this reptilian headed shape. And there's actually a scene where he has the red suit on, but then he puts on the green helmet. Like, he loses the red helmet, or vice versa. But there is a point where he's wearing, like, a green helmet on the red suit.
Right, it switches, yeah.
So,
well, in the Transformer, when you see him with the green helmet on, below him is Wendy wearing the green shirt, or the green dress.
Interesting.
And those are the two key scenes where Bowman's going to disconnect Hal and Wendy is about to disconnect Jack.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
So these
they're major malfunctioning.
When I was watching The Shining smoking DMT and fucking Jack Nicholson turns into a reptile. It's the only experience I've ever had where I saw a fucking shape-shifting reptile with DMT, but it was in the bathroom scene when he's talking to Grady. And his face just started. At first, it looked like his face was going to explode, like it was just expanding in all directions. And in my room at the time, I only had one red light bulb above me. And so I was in this red room, and he's in the red fucking bathroom, and that totally went down. So I resonate with you in the red room of the 2001 where he looks like a reptile in terms of the cartoonish reflection. That's cool.
Well, what's fascinating is that at that key moment when Wendy finally locks Jack into his cell, a room which he could survive for months if it only had a bathroom, and then upstairs you have Bowman who finally disconnects Hal. In the soundtrack, you hear the turning on of a television, and then Bowman turns over and he sees a television, and these messages of revelation start beaming out of the TV.
Bill, to me, that's one of the strongest connections. Like, that moment is one of the strongest connections in your arrangement of the Transformer. Like, that moment gave me shivers. Like, that was incredible.
Well, she says, you know, want to take a bath? What are you watching? I mean, it's just complete everything. It's like a big crunch, man. Everything is converging in that 3 minutes. And I haven't necessarily completed my own personal exegesis of what that means to me, but I know it's there. So if you have a chance to rewatch that sometime and share your thoughts, it'd be much appreciated.
What's the name that gets said in the Miss Bancroft?
Yes.
I don't know what that means. Have you thought about that? Have you looked into that, Miss Bancroft?
It didn't.
And Bancroft, the graduate?
Is that the name of the actress who plays Mrs. Robinson or something?
I haven't deciphered that movie clip completely.
Is that right? Is that the name of the actress in The Graduate?
It's the actress. Out. Yeah.
Yeah, we watched that the other night too. The Graduate. Huh. Okay.
Which, by the way, features so it's all Simon and Garfunkel. What I found myself meditating on last night was the idea that if there was a connection at the moment where the Paul McCartney has his post 9/11 concert, David Bowie starts the concert up by singing the song "America" by Simon and Garfunkel, and it's really, I mean, it's like such a deep. There's like a million ways to run with this because it seems ritualistic almost to have David Bowie come out and sing the song to open this thing. But at the same time, there's like the song, you know, says it evokes this sort of longing to find America and this idea of paranoia. You know, it says like, we played games with the scenery. She says, the man in the gabardine suit is a spy. I said, be careful. His bow tie is really a camera. Like, it evokes this, like, paranoia. And it's beautifully, this beautiful rendition. So, it's, but like I said, you could run with it a million ways. But I was specifically wondering last night, what is the connection with Simon and Garfunkel? Like, I joked to myself, I was, bear in mind, I'm like, was on an 8-hour bus ride, so I just had time to just sit and like my mind wandering. But I was thinking to myself, another Simon and Garfunkel song is "I Am a Rock."
Mm-hmm. I'm an island.
No man is an island, but in this song he says, "I am a rock." So Bill says Manhattan is an island, but who do we go to war with after 9/11?
Iraq.
That's pretty good.
And Jason has pointed out that what we're really talking about here is the Philosopher's Stone. It's the Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's. I explain all this in the book.
But I just.
It's Miss Foreign Affairs, essentially. It's all just Dr. Strangelove, and Iraq is Miss Foreign Affairs, and we're going to bomb the hell out of it.
So dropping bombs on them is the same thing as basically.
It was the shock and awe bomb.
Yeah, but okay. So I want to ask you a specific question: the shock and awe, the like when we say the Marilyn Monroe is a bombshell, right? The blonde bombshell. So here she is the missile. She's the the warhead, but at the same time, this is very phallic stuff. So is do we take this as this is the feminine armed with the phallus? You know,
no, it's the handmaid.
Well, if you refer back to Full Metal Jacket, you will see the scene where he says, "You will give your rifle a girl's name because it's the only pussy you people are going to get."
Charlene, but it's not actually the Shakina. It's the representation of her. It's the mirror image of her that's not really her. It's like her fucking evil twin. It's the handmaiden that's taken over the tree. That's the shell. That's the Kleepote. The Kleepote take over the tree. So the bombshell isn't actually Shakina. It's her representation. It's like in her place we have this character, which is the Lamed, you know.
Do you make a connection when you said that the handmaiden has taken over the tree? I'm sure this has been done in a lot of places, but I thought of Natalie Portman in Star Wars movie where she pretends to be the handmaiden?
Right.
Where the handmaiden is actually the queen in disguise.
Totally. Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that there's no, it's like a Vedantic issue, where it's like we're talking about an illusion, but there is no Maya without Brahm, right? And that Maya is actually Brahm, but it's like the false mask of Brahm, you know? That the mask isn't actually separate from the thing. It's not like there is anything else. Pan is the all, there's nothing beyond it, you know? But there's... you could call them outside forces, but there's no, you know, there's no reality to them other than the reality that they're inseminated with through the power of our imagination.
Yeah.
So I take it as that's like, in as far as our brain is concerned, it's in the mind. We have a representational holographic model of the thing that isn't actually the thing. And that if our vision was cleansed, you know, if the doors of perception were cleansed, we would see things as they are, which is infinite. But as long as we see birth, growth, decay, and death, it's the Shakina becomes a bombshell. You know, we're not seeing her for what she is, which is united with Zaire. So the masculine and the feminine principles tie everything back together. But then the tree folded into itself is everything static. In order for things to stand out in space the way that they do, in order for things to manifest, you need the split. And so it's a it's a necessary sacrifice in order for the expansion. The two are mutually interdependent. So yeah, I feel that that's the whole joke with with Lilith, you know, is that she's this, you know, holographic representation of the thing, but there's a kernel of truth inherent in it because it's you know,
Colonel Kurtz.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing in the vision and the voice, the second and third ethers, where it discusses how the magician has ensorcelled of Babylon, which requires a necessary correction in becoming the new magician.
Yes.
And such, which is the whole king killing theorem, and why Stanley Kubrick is the great magician with Stella.
Uh huh.
And. So like Kubrick's done kind of like Metatron kind of role in front of
the Shekinah, fucking architect.
But where it's like Metatron is like the architect of the Shekinah, which also kind of fits Hartman's role, because he's always telling them to love the Virgin Mary, but he's kind of the dweller on the threshold there who's, you know, gonna kick the shit out of them if they don't.
Yes.
Which is the fundamental paradox of things.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's basically that the only way beyond the illusion is directly through, and that means the blood, sweat, and pain and fucking everything, you know? Yeah. Yeah, and turning the shit into gold, too, you know?
Right, that's the whole thing with Private Pyle, where he's like the prima materia of the alchemist that the Joker is going to refine, and he's kind of stuck with him. He doesn't like it, but, you know, he's stuck with him, and he's got to refine that crude material into something better. Mm-hmm. It doesn't quite work out that way.
Yeah. Huh. Isn't the New Jerusalem described as all gold? Isn't that the deal? So I saw before me in a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and that the New Jerusalem is all jewels and gold. It's like that, you know, the that it's it, that, and that that comes out of the shit, you know. What was a world of shit becomes a world of gold.
Isn't that that sailing to Byzantium thing? I should become a creature of gold, or once out of nature. Which, that's the poem where the No Country for Old Men title comes from.
Yeah, it's like if you have the gold room in The Shining, then you have the shit room is room 237.
Well, I mean, how do we fit the bathroom then? Because the ultimate...
Oh, there you go. That's the shit room, sure.
The ultimate confrontation occurs, you know, here's Johnny in the bathroom.
Right, the two bathrooms too. That's also
obviously they're all the same bathroom. It's all like the same place. Just like how in Eyes Wide Shut, like he keeps going to all these different places, but they're all just like right across the street from each other.
Yes, exactly. I love that, dude. I love that. Oh God, and it's not even in New York.
Right.
There's one scene that's filmed in New York though, and that's the weird kicker. It's like, wow, he went to the trouble to film a scene, and I forget what scene it was. I need to look it up again.
It's what the one movie with the Pink Panther sign. The Pink Cat sign.
That's in New York.
Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah, Eyes Wide Shut. That scene is in... There's a scene in New York, right?
Yeah, it's the one with the Pink Panther sign.
I'm trying to remember where that is. When that is. When is that? Huh. Do you know what scene the Pink Panther...
doesn't it say like pink pussy? It's like a clothing store
pink
or a
cat,
boutique.
Pink pussy, pink cat, or something.
That's so weird that they go to the trouble to film a scene in New York and then every other scene is filmed elsewhere. I don't get it. And move around all the fucking signs for days and change everything up. Like, that's something else. It's all one cab too, right? The cabs all have the same license plate or something?
Oh, probably.
That's pretty interesting if that's true.
Yeah, no, there's something like that. I'll look it up. You probably know where to find. There's people have gone to extreme lengths to show what's actually happening in terms of what you're seeing and what's being rearranged and where you're actually at in terms of the map. It's weird. He goes all across town and then he's across the street from where he was originally.
It's a dream. I mean, it's a dream novel. That's the source material, correct?
Sure. I mean, did you guys read the Alice's original dream in the original screenplay of Eyes Wide Shut?
Yes.
Yes, I made a whole post about it, man.
Oh, did you? I didn't read it.
You should read that.
I
was inspired by you and your genius.
Oh, really? Cool.
Well, when I read it on your blog originally.
Yeah, I had it quite a while ago. I reposted it on this one just because it's so applicable, because I want to stress the Eden thing, or Aiden, you know, I want to show
I want to just put in the crucified part because of the Ballad of John and Yoko, where, you know, the way things are going, they're going to crucify me.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's getting with the Asian girl again.
Right, and that they're the two virgins, and they were naked and were not ashamed. Yeah. Wow.
Because with the other part, it's like a different girl, because it's Dallas is like the light in all things, whereas Yoko is like matter. She's Asya, and then John Lennon is Christ, who's going to crucify himself on the cross of matter and drain his blood into it.
Has anyone considered that? So Doug pointed out that in the Shining novel, it's room 217, but in the Shining movie, it's changed to room 237. Does anyone consider that the two virgins, John and Yoko, made a whole big deal out of the whole bag in, right? They were going to get into a bag?
Bag is them.
Right, but what is a bag? Right, wait. Break it down. B, yeah. B, B is the second letter. A is the first letter. G is the seventh letter. Bag. They're getting in the bag. They're going into room 217.
Wow. That's great. Yeah, you want to see the most beautiful thing I ever filmed? So, basically, at the end of American Beauty, during the credits, they give a special thanks to, first of all, who's the lead singer of The Who?
Pete Town. Oh, Roger Daltrey.
No, Pete Townsend.
He's not the lead singer. Pete Townsend is the guitar player.
Oh, is he Tommy in the movie or something?
Yeah, so Tommy in the movie is Roger Daltrey.
Oh, okay. So who's Pete Townsend then? He's in The Who, right?
How do you not? I'm gonna fly all the way over there and smack you with a Who album.
I'm not a huge Who fan. I never really been.
No, it's it's all good. I just really like them. No, yeah, Pete Townsend is the guitar player.
Okay.
And he's basically the brains. I mean, it's all him, but he's not the voice. But he comes up with the arrangements. He comes up with the lyrics. He does everything, but he's not the voice.
Okay, so here's the thing. American Beauty is a Rosicrucian film, okay? American Beauty, Grateful Dead, the fucking American Beauty is the Red Rose, right? RR, okay? The Who's Tommy is a Rosicrucian film, okay? Tommy's got the fucking cube on his head. They keep showing you the crosses with the rose in the center, right? It's the cube of space folded up with the essence inside, right? So at the end of American Beauty, they give a special thanks to Pete Townshend and Dr. Bill and Alice right next to each other. Like,
okay, but American Beauty is also just like a big Lolita thing as well, with Angela Hayes being the girl's name.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. I hadn't considered that, but I like, yeah, totally. And so he's looking through the albums, Kevin Spacey, and he goes, "You like Pink Floyd?" And he goes, "I like a lot of music." It's like they're like, "Look closer," you know. It's on his desk. If you look closer, it says, "Look closer." You know, they want you to get this, you know. And it's at the end of the credits, you know, they show you this little thing. It's like a nod to fucking Dr. Bill and Alice. Like, that's not a mistake. Bill is the fucking lizard from Alice in Wonderland. Alice is Alice.
Oh my God! Yeah, and Bill the lizard in Alice in Wonderland, he has to get the ladder. He has Jacob's ladder.
That's right. And then the other thing is that their daughter in Eyes Wide Shut is named Helena. The mother of Alice in Alice in Wonderland's name is Helena. What is she doing at the beginning of Eyes Wide Shut? She's studying. What is Alice doing with her mother at the beginning of Eyes Wide Shut? She's studying. Except in Eyes Wide Shut, she's studying with the fucking babysitter.
Wow.
But even in Alice in Wonderland, she's not studying with her mother. She's studying with, I believe, an older sister or a nanny.
Oh, is that what it is? I didn't know. I was thinking.
Oh, man. I have... it's not handy. I have, yeah.
I think it's Blavatsky. I think that's their joke.
Sure.
And Alice Bailey.
Yeah.
Like Alice Bailey and Blavatsky fucking playing off of each other or something weird like that. I mean, that's a time frame.
So, fuck, man. That's really interesting. So do you think that the Eyes Wide Shut is the dream of the little girl? The same way that Alice falls asleep, and it's...
I've considered that, and then that's the Nutcracker.
Right.
I don't think so. I think it's kind of Alice's dream.
What's that?
I feel like it's kind of Alice's dream, but, like, there's a connection between Mandy and Helena as well, since they're both red-haired girls.
Hmm. Yeah, the double.
So I don't know. I explained it with where, like, it's, like, Alice starts out in, like, Kether, and then she descends the tree into material life, and then after the party's over, they step out of the party, and then the real hero's journey back into oneness commences, where Dr. Bill has to kind of heal things.
Right.
Because Alice has kind of been a little slutty.
Well, she's...
A bit of a horror of Babylon.
Acknowledging what fucking every fucking married couple experiences. and never wants to fucking talk about. You know, it's the big fucking pink elephant in the room that they pretend isn't there, which is that the human nature is at the drop of anything, the way desire works. You know, desire.
Yeah, but
it's
not really about that, man.
Desirelessness is moksha. It's as simple as that. You know.
It's not really about that, though. It's about how she's inside of Bill Seaman, basically, which is the whole thing with the naval officer. It's just a big joke, if you get it.
The naval officer?
The naval officer is the seaman.
Uh-huh.
And so it's kind of like the scene where she reveals to Bill is the hermit card, which is about sublimating semen again. And so,
yeah, oh, it's multi-layered, you know. But
which is also why, you know, Humbert gives Lolita a big sandwich of mayonnaise.
Right. Right. Totally. I made it the way you like it, with lots of mayonnaise. But then if you like the I forget, Hungarian guy, the vampire,
yes.
Who recognizes that she's fucking menstruating because she goes to the bathroom twice. She goes to the bathroom in the apartment, she gets to the party, she goes to the bathroom again. And he's just like, oh, blood, nice.
He's the devil. He represents the black tradition of the Death Eater. The consumption of the menstrual blood as the black tradition, as opposed to Kubrick's alchemical gnosis.
Right.
And so, yeah.
Huh. Yeah. No, I realized that connection with Marilyn Manson's album Eat Me, Drink Me, which is a reference to Alice in Wonderland, obviously. And
right.
The first song of it, it was If I Was Your Vampire. And it's Christmas morning, you know, that's the beginning of the song is, you know, 9 a.m. Christmas morning or something like that. And then, so If I Was Your Vampire, it just all kind of went, I was like, huh. But
yeah, the whole scene where Alice is dancing with him is kind of like her little Pleasure Island experience, because you notice that he opens talking about Ovid on the Art of Love, and then she talks about how didn't he die somewhere, not very nice, but you know, he says, but he had a lot of fun before that. So
maybe this is obvious. Is this maybe I missed this? This was the connection you guys were making, that in Full Metal Jacket, they mention it's Christmas, and that's when the magic show is later that night. In Eyes Wide Shut, it's Christmas, and he goes to the magic show. He goes to the Secret Society's magic ritual.
Yeah, where the rainbow ends.
But I guess that's what you... If I missed that, if that was what you were saying, like, the idea that that's the magic show. I also have here, when you guys were talking about... So if Alice... Jason said that Alice is like Mandy, that he... So they were sort of two sides of the same... woman, because they were both have the red hair. There's
well, it's the male.
No, I meant Helena, but also Mandy. They're all kind of the same woman, really. All
right, I want you to realize something. There's a song called Mandy, right?
Uh-huh.
It's like the Barry Manilow, but he actually didn't write it. So I'm looking at the Wikipedia page. The song was originally called Brandy, but the title was changed to Mandy to avoid confusion with the song Brandy, You're a Fine Girl, which is performed by a band called Looking Glass. So, not to be confused with the Looking Glass, we changed the song to Mandy. I think that's really interesting.
Oh, God. I love
it's
it.
It's twisted.
I don't think, you know, Kubrick was sitting around going, how do I make a reference to a bad Barry Manilow song? But I think that's...
But that was his favorite song. Didn't you read that?
Are you serious?
No, I'm kidding. Sorry.
You had me go for a
like,
second. I was like,
no,
get the
I
fuck out of here.
Go, I wouldn't be surprised if you showed me the reference and it checked out. I would accept it because I've had to accept a lot of these things eventually. So, huh. I was thinking of that cheesy 90s movie. I think it was the 90s. Where the kid is interested in the girl named Amanda and he... wants to make a request or something he wants to talk to Barry Manilow on a radio station, and he's trying to get through, and the angel, the stripper dressed up as an angel, hangs up the phone. What is that called? Do you know what I'm talking about? My girlfriend loves it. I can't remember the name, but I haven't seen it in years. But it's got Seth Green in it.
Seth Green.
And it's like it's their like last day of high school or something, maybe, or I don't know, I can't remember.
I don't know.
Oh god, whatever. It's a cheesy ass movie, but that's just significant that the angel stripper hangs up the fucking phone on him while he's trying to call Barry Manilow to ask if Mandy was named for someone named Amanda and that is short, or if the name was Mandy.
That's really it. And of course, so Seth Green being our resident green man. Jason, I'm getting crazy. Jason, I'm getting crazy noise from your end.
Sorry, I had something on the microphone.
I understand. You were just getting excited thinking about Amanda. Amanda.
I wanted to think that it's like a man, duh. Like, duh, it's a man, and then it's the other side of the being, that the double is that it's the male and the female side or something.
Because the woman in the woman who plays Mandy actually looks very masculine.
She yeah, she does.
A really manly face. Mandy has a manly face.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad I'm a man, and so is Lola.
Yeah, right.
What was that?
Lola. And
oh, right, Lola, like carbonated soda. S-O-D-A.
Which, of course, Weird Al... which Weird Al turned into Yoda, and Yoda's also a little green man.
Right. I was trying to tell Amy about it, and she was like, Yoda? No, I don't know. I'm like, no, Weird Al, Yoda, and I played it for her, and she's just, like, nodding her head, like, no, this is wrong. But it's like, Lola, you know?
Jason, Jason, have you considered that you put in this post you said you kept pinging with, American Pie. For some reason, the song American Pie kept pinging for you. Do you realize that Weird Al has two Star Wars songs? One is a parody of Lola, and the other is a parody of American Pie.
The yes, saga begins.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he does American Pie as the first Star Wars episode one is all American Pie, and then he makes Lola into Yoda, so that you're getting both Lolita. Like, connected through this, you're getting both American Pie and Lolita resonating back to this handmaiden that's pretending to be the queen.
Mm-hmm. Jack,
you're going to get hit with the Weird Al record there, Jason.
Yeah.
Well, Weird Al's great for sync. I use Weird Al all the time. He's perfect. Yeah, I think I'm a clone now. The clone thing kept coming up because of TK421. So 421, right? And that's the stormtrooper that they dress up as when they get the Luke dresses up as.
Right, right, right.
So it was just this whole thing of reoccurring TK421 in Boogie Nights when he works at the stereo place and he's like, oh, but you won't get that with the TK421. And I go looking up TK421 and I find out there's a copier that's called TK421. Copier. The clones. The fucking stormtroopers are clones. So, I don't know.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, he played with that a lot. I don't know if it was anywhere in THX 1138. I kind of wanted to look into that. They may have done it when they remastered it or something, snuck it in there. But, yeah.
Jesus Christ. So,
where are we?
What?
Where are we?
I have no idea. We somehow Weird Al, and then things got weird, and
somewhere Nibiru and Tatooine.
Oh, if you get lost between the moon and
right,
yeah, and
moon in New York City, the moon, the twin towers of the moon card. If you get lost between the moon and New York City, well, then you find yourself at the twin towers of the moon tarot card.
Or the death card, either one, because they're both in there.
Yeah.
That's Arthur's theme, I think. Isn't that the song?
Of course, the king at the King Arthur.
That was one of the most interesting things, I think, that one of the more interesting things that Crowley got into was the his take on the golden bough and how that relates to the tree of life. And basically, the slave killing the king and marrying the king's daughter and taking over the kingdom, and that's what's regenerating the tree.
Yeah, so that's really what all of these stories are about.
And the implications of if you try and keep it strictly in the family and what that begins to look like due to the stagnation of the, then you have the dying tree, which Blavatsky talks about in The Secret Doctrine.
Where does Crowley write about the Golden Bough?
In the Book of Thoth, actually, he goes into it, and in a number of other places that I could look up if you want me to. I have
the Fool.
Fucking
Crowley. I've quoted it before.
What's that?
I've quoted it before. The part about the Fool.
Yeah, and the Fool is specifically where he goes into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the one I quoted that in my blogs was the Season of the Witch, I believe.
But I would actually, if you know, no rush, but if at any point you know the specifically where that is, I'd be very interested in that because
you can look up. You mean for my blog or
no? It doesn't matter. I'm sure I could look up, you know, Crowley Golden Bough. I just
it's in the Book of Thoth in the section on the Fool. That's where you'll find it.
Okay. Because that's really where my head is just in the Golden Bough intensely. specifically, it's heavy into that, but I feel like, I don't know, there's this this element there that I think ultimately for me seems to tie together so much of this stuff. And, you know, no one element is more important than the other. I've just sort of chosen to zero in on this particular element because this is something that, since, like, my biggest, I think, entranceway... That's awesome. My sort of entryway into Sync really came around with focus, like sort of meditating on the number 317, and you know, which is basically the date of Osiris's death, and this has been sort of, it's because, again, maybe because it was my entrance point, it's something that has resonated so strongly throughout my work. And particularly now that, you know, I ended up changing, again, not realizing, but changing my name when I got married to Green. So I'm Osiris. I got into Sync because of Osiris's death. Perhaps it's my own death. I don't know, but I'm fascinated by it. And that's like where I keep returning to. And that's why, you know, this idea of Kubrick's bathtub is so fascinating to me. This is where the king dies, after all.
When it goes to room 237, it cuts to the scene with Halloran, who is our Osiris figure, sitting on the bed. And the bed is a very specific green color, which is the color of a pool table.
Yep.
And so it's Osiris in the pool again.
That's awesome.
It's a little pun that goes. It's a visual pun that goes through a lot of his movies. It's a green pool table color.
Wow. What do you think of the Empress being green, and the idea proposed by Jodorowsky in terms of the hermaphrodite in tarot, and that the world card or the universe is a hermaphrodite, which is the reconciliation, which is basically Keter meaning Malkut, in a sense. Yep. Basically, that the universe ties it back around, and that the Fool and the magician are the Fool is actually the feminine, and the magician being the masculine, the will and the receptivity, and then the cross of the High Priestess and the Empress basically being the crossing of the abyss, literally the crossing. And that's why you have, you know, the whole green thing of Venus. Kind of weird.
Yes.
But
I want to ask along a similar lines. I actually had a question for Jason. Was the I thought it was really, really genius. I don't know which one of you caught this. The idea that the opening scene to Clockwork Orange, those bricks leading up, does look like a pyramid. So it's the light at the top of the pyramid, and then again, the projector room for Clockwork Orange, those sort of beige seats make up the brick pyramid. It really, once you see the visual, like you said, it's a visual pun, it's really ingenious. But I guess my question was, if we refer to the projector, right, the film projector, but Stanley Kubrick is the cameraman, he's the receiver. The camera receives light and sort of imprints it, and then it gets projected back. So this was something else I was thinking about last night, and I wanted to know if you guys had any thought on this, the distinction between the projector is what you're seeing, but that the movie, the filmmaker, is very much a receiver. We even say actors have to be projective figures, so they are...
Right, that's the whole thing where the filmmaker makes shadows, which are then projected on the wall, but the light is pure.
Right.
But the director is the great magician, so he has to create shadows in order for images to appear on the wall.
But I guess, my question was specifically, the fact that technically he's not the magician projecting images, he's actually the receiver. By working the camera, he's receiving the light. And technically how a camera works, right, is you're trapping light and that image.
Right.
And then later it gets projected out. But, this is semantics, that it's sort of like an Ouroboros, you know, where he's receiving it and then spitting it back out at you. But I just specifically want you to zero in on, for a moment, on the fact that he's receiving the light first. When he's making the movie, he's a receiver.
Oh, I definitely resonate with that. But it's actually a perfect... mutual balance of will and receptivity that are involved in the action, and that's, you know, it's, yeah.
I like that a lot, Alan. I think I, obviously it's something that you know on the surface, but I've never really put the emphasis more on the receptivity of his craft, because anyone can project a light through his imprinted film at that point. So I like that. I never thought of it that way.
Hmm. Yeah, he's kind of the hermit there, where he's holding the light out and kind of turning away in a sense too, you know. You know what I'm talking about? With Cerebus,
yes.
in the Crowley deck, it's really like, I mean, it's in the other one too, but it's really emphasized, you know. I've looked at him as the hermit before, and then thought about Led Zeppelin 4 with Stairway to Heaven. When you unfold that album, you know, you can, first of all, the cover is obviously the Ten of Wands. You can see the oppression.
Yes, yes.
Right.
Yes.
And you open it up and you have him climbing up to meet the hermit. You know, I've always kind of felt like the way Kubrick presents it is kind of like, you know, you can climb up to get to the illuminated place, but only if you take all these pieces and do the whole thing, as far as his arena is concerned, that he's kind of set up for himself, you know.
Right, that the Ten Wands is almost too much to handle. That's why the guy is struggling with it, but ultimately that you would need all of that, you know, turn it up to 10. Or as you said last week, if you really want to get that kundalini going in your spinal tap, you turn it up to 11.
Right. I was considering that, you know, you can't really turn it up to 11 unless if you're ready and willing to turn it up to 12. If you want to look at the 11 being the 11 sephirot, which is really, you know, non-existent, you know, or at least, I don't know, it's kind of like, it's weird because you fold it in. So you'd fold Chokhmah and Bina into Chesed and Gevura, and in that you're folding space, you're traveling without moving. So you'd have to be willing to go to 12, even though you won't really have to, because it's a realization in going to 11 that you can fold it back and not actually have to go any further. If that makes sense.
Yeah, the Tesseract.
Right.
Yes.
So what What's Lon Milo Duquette's thing here with the Apollo 11 thing? He's ruining the perfect symmetry of the 10.
Well, it's that's the illusion. Like, if the tree was, if everything was balanced, everything's static. So you need the illusion to maintain the Maya, if you will. That's the whole thing with Patanjali. You know, once you reach Kaivalya, you're basic, like, you, when you go through the different samadhis, you reach the point where there's nowhere left to go in the world. Like, the world doesn't exist for you. There's no moving about. So that's the difference you'll find with, like, certain teachers who present the Vedantic view that the absolute liberated being is still in the world, whereas the old Samkhyas would say otherwise. And this was the old debate, which was supposedly reconciled with the Bhagavad Gita, speaking of I am become death, you know.
Well, that's the end of Full Metal Jacket, where he says he's still in a world of shit, but he is alive, and he's not afraid.
Well, that's a level of samadhi, but that's not Kaivalya. If it was the highest level of samadhi, there's no more moving about. But that's whatever. That's death.
That would be David Bowman, right? Where he's gone beyond infinity
and back again. Yeah.
Right. But I think Jason's point is very valid. That yeah, ultimately these are two examples. But David Bowman had to come back. He's a little bodhisattva. But the fact that by being no longer afraid and accepting his place in the world of shit, that's its own form of, you know, attainment, if nothing else.
I think that William just nailed it down there with they walk from right to left, is that they're going from Chokhmah, which is the wisdom that they gained in basically the gangbang murder, to go to the back to the understanding. And so it's not, it's what it's expressed in Full Metal Jacket isn't the ultimate like it is in 2001. It's a reconciliation of Chokhmah and Bina and that marriage. I mean, I don't, it just seems like it's showing a certain level of something, but it's not going to back around the tree like it does in 2001, where they completely fold it back into itself, if that makes sense.